because the clicks are a little bit random.
Yeah, understood. Probably the same thing if I go through the other repeater. Let me try that.
How's this, WS?
Your voice is deeper, but the crackles are worse. So go back to the first repeater. Oh, by the way, can you aim the antenna when you're going through the second repeater?
I could swing it all the way around, but I don't want to do that because I got some issues with that wire up there. I still got to get up there and change that. Okay, I'm on 5. I'm going back to 3. We'll go back to 3. All right, about there. How's that?
3 is quite good. So please proceed from there, Paul. Go ahead.
1 second. Okay, that's odd. How copy, Dick? I hit a button here and hit my, I hit a wrong button. WS2N.
Quite good, Paul. 10% crackle, 90% audio. So please proceed.
Okay, understood. Very good. Curiosity, your robot on Mars leaving our Vera Rubin Ridge, they call it. Vera Rubin, it was named after her. She's the one that really pretty much figured out a lot of things to do with dark matter, so they named this ridge after her. And it's now leaving that area after months and months of digging up rocks and drilling through rocks and testing and finally moving on. But doing very well. And going to go on to another area. It landed in 2012, and here we are in 2019. Curiosity is doing good. Along the way, every time it does stop, they take, let's call them gravity measurements. You know, they're going up a mountain called Mount Sharp, and it's, you know, it started back in 2012 relatively low in this mountain that's located in Gale Crater. And over the time, they're going up higher and higher, and they've taken up to 700 different measurements over the years, and they're doing it with accelerometers and their version of a compass, not really a compass. They have gyros on board. Not spinning gyros, these are mechanical, but essentially it's an IC, very small type of thing that's mounted on the inside of Curiosity. But they, nevertheless, they're able to tell which direction it's facing and the pull of the gravity in that area. Now, over these years, they can tell now how dense this mountain is. They predicted it was going to be very dense, but it looks like it's a lot more porous than they thought. That's a sign that they get, one of the signs, pieces of information they're getting out of Curiosity. And they came up with this idea. Originally, it wasn't planned, wasn't one of their plans. They did it because the Apollo 17 astronauts did it on the moon. Back in 1972, they drove around on the moon, and they took around 25 different measurements from those experiments, and they were able to tell them densities of wherever they might, they might be on the moon. They drove, like, I think, a total of 17 miles. With Curiosity, they got the same idea to use gyroscopes and accelerometers, and they found out every time the rover was standing still, they could take a measurement. It was moving, it wouldn't work. But it's just one of the byproducts out of the 10 different instruments that they have on board Curiosity. When I went up in 2012, they never even thought of this. Now they have not only done it, they've come up with results. So I thought that was pretty good. Curiosity still fired up, no problem, because it's got an RTG on board, a radioisotope. isotope thermoelectric generator powered by plutonium-238. So, to worry about the sun, like opportunity still hasn't been heard from last October. It doesn't look really too good for opportunity, although they're still trying. Never know, they might get a signal between now and when they cut off funding in about a month or two. This is WS2S. Not much news lately coming out of NASA because of the shutdown, but now they're starting to release more information. For instance, there was a story about Parker, that's the solar probe, that has already gone through one complete orbit around the sun, and it's come all the way back to the distance of the Earth, so roughly 93 million miles back from the sun. Made this elliptical orbit, came in very close to the sun, inside Mercury. Mercury had to be 33 million, and this thing went around 25 million. Every time it goes around, it's going to cut the distance down even further, getting closer and closer to the sun. So right now, it came back to the distance of where Earth was. Well, right now, Earth, we're actually on the opposite side of where the sun is right now. So Earth is moving around a couple of times. Now it's going to start inward again, going to a perihelion, and it will go in a lot closer. I have a drawing here, and it shows that it's going to go in a lot closer, so I'm guessing probably about 15 million miles or so. Ultimate goal is, over the years, over seven passes, it should get as close as, I think, 3.7 million miles from the sun. And naturally, each time it does that, they're going to get a lot more science out of it. Now, this thing was launched only, 6 months ago or so. On a Delta IV Heavy rocket, NASA's biggest rocket that we use, the Delta IV, and they bolted three of them together to put this piano-sized spacecraft into solar orbit. So it's still good. Let me just drop it. If anybody has any questions before I go on to... Next topic. I talked about the crewed version of the Dragon spacecraft that's being developed by SpaceX. First mission, they're going to call it Demo 1 or DM-1. DM-1 keeps being delayed. I'm talking about this was supposed to go up in 2018, and then they talked about the beginning of January, and then there was the shutdown. Or as I like to call it, a lockout. So basically, that slowed things down. And now they delay it again and again. And then the last new launch will be March 2nd. We'll see if it makes that date. It's an interesting launch because it's not the cargo version. It's the crewed version. It has seats in it and it has everything that humans would need. It has propulsion, it has oxygen, it has water in the tanks, and, just a duplicate of what you would need if you're going to put four people on board this spacecraft and send it to the space station. But this is the demo. It's going to go up, it's going to dock at the space station, and then return. And it's launching from Launch Complex 39A. Same launch complex that the Saturn V rocket used to launch to the moon, or over half the amount of shuttles that took off from that launch complex. The other half took off from Launch Complex 39B. And that's another story. That one's being developed by NASA to launch Orion spacecraft on top of the Space Launch System that they're developing. Those two launch pads sure are not going to waste. And that complex will also be used for what used to be called Orbital ATK. Now it's owned by Northrop Grumman. And they're developing a heavy lift vehicle also. They used to call it the next generation watch vehicle. And I gave it a name, Omega. Omega will also be launching from Launch Complex 39B. But the demo, one flight, and the crew flight, a couple months after that, will all be launching from 39A. That's when that SpaceX took over. And they utilized two launch complexes in Florida, in Cape Canaveral 39A, and they also utilized launch complex 40. 40 is one that they're using now for a lot of commercial launches, as well as another launch complex in California, Vandenberg Air Force Base, and presently under construction another one in Texas, in Boca Chica, Texas, right near Brownsville. So, but I'd like to see this demo mission get off the ground. It's got the cap that's going to open up in the front, physically dock with the space station into the Harmony node, stay there a couple of weeks, and actually deliver some cargo. The crew will actually go into it on the space station, unload the few things that it's going to send up. Then autonomously, it will disconnect from the space station and re-enter the atmosphere with parachutes, heat shields, and land in the Pacific Ocean, similar to what the cargo version does. So it's a little different than the cargo version. Like, for instance, the trunk that they have in the back is a lot more stuff inside to support the astronauts in water. And a lot more fuel. And it also has solar panels that attached to the trunk of the spacecraft, so you're not going to have these big wings pop out like you see on the Dragon crew vehicle. That usually pops out with two big panels, four square sections to each wing. This has none of that. It's just solar panels mounted to the trunk of the body. And that doesn't come back when the demo demo one and actually demo two return. Just the spacecraft itself comes back, the trunk. And when I say the trunk, it's a big piece. It's equivalent to the same size, but it's not bigger than the spacecraft itself. So that part will come back. And they'll pick it up, test everything, make sure it's okay. And if that's okay, they'll send a two-person crew up in a couple of months, probably in the summertime. Once NASA accepts it, certifies it for a launch, it'll be regular flights of the space station. With either probably three in the beginning, and then eventually four per flight. Four people in the spacecraft. The spacecraft has the capability of putting seven up if they wanted to. There's no plan for that. Let's see, another mission that's not manned, that's planned, is called Lucy. Lucy is not an acronym. They're naming it after one of the discoveries years ago in archaeology. They found this person and they called him Lucy, which is millions of years old, and it was thought to be the first, one of the first human beings that walked the Earth. That's changed since then, but nevertheless, they're naming this launch that's going to go out to the Jupiter area, Lucy. It's been funded, and they actually have dates of when they're going to launch this thing. But it's going to be launched on an Atlas V rocket. They weren't too sure if they were going to choose them or not. They have a 100% success rate. And I think roughly $500 million on this one, and Psyche, another spacecraft that's going to be going out to the same area. This one's going out to Jupiter, and it's going to investigate the Trojan asteroids, the L4, the L5 position. And this is going to take many, many years to do. It's going to leave here 2022. I actually have a date, October 16th. And an actual window for this year, well, not this year, the 2022nd year and 2023rd. After that, then it won't have a launch date. But the window will have closed. But if they get it off roughly 1,000 days from now, they will be able to not only go to the first group of asteroids. After that, the spacecraft will actually start coming back toward Earth, past Earth, and go to another set of asteroids in the opposite area. Instead of being millions of miles ahead of Jupiter, it will be millions of miles behind Jupiter. This is another group of asteroids. So, Lucy's been funded, has a rocket, has a date. In fact, it's got a starting date, and it even has an ending date. One of the last asteroids is going to pass is in 2033. That's the story on Lucy. Last topic I had was a topic that I've been following for quite a while. It looks like Israel is going to be the fourth country to actually land a spacecraft on the moon. Yeah. This one particular group in Israel has built a spacecraft, and the name of the company is SpaceIL. It's an Israeli company, and they've built this thing over many, many years, and they've developed it, and they believe it will be able to land on the moon. They just needed somebody to launch it there, so they signed up with SpaceX. SpaceX, later this month, the date I'm shown is the 18th of February, so about a couple of weeks from now. They're going to launch from Launch Complex 40, Cape Canaveral. And it's a dual mission, really. SpaceX is going to put an Indonesian communications spacecraft into orbit, into a geosynchronous orbit. And when it's out in that area, after it's released that Indonesian communications satellite, it will release SpaceIL. Their lander, and that will go out to the moon. The idea is just to land it, and it's going to be sending back pictures of itself. Somehow it's going to be able to take a selfie, they said. I don't see any robotic arm on this thing, but maybe it does have something. Or it's going to either put a camera, maybe it's just going to do what Curiosity does, maybe some kind of pictures, you know, of itself. Maybe you're going to get a piece of it here and there. They said they're going to be able to do that. And they'll be the fourth country to develop a landing craft that will be able to do that. There's also going to be scientific tests on. They're going to test the magnetic field in the area. They want to see how rocks and lunar surface pick up a magnetic field from either the sun or the solar system, or from where they're trying to figure out over time. This is not going to go anywhere. It doesn't have a rover. Over time, we just want to see how magnetic fields develop on the moon. And that's just started with SpaceIL's vehicle. It's not too big. It's got a 2 meter diameter and roughly 2 meter high. It's a little smaller than that, but a high vehicle. It has four legs, actually four kind of communications. It doesn't have an RTG, it has solar panels. So I'm suspecting it probably won't make the lunar night, but with the solar panels it does have. So it'll probably get almost a couple of weeks out of the spacecraft. And that's the story. You know, a couple of other launches that are going to be going up that I'm paying attention to. I mentioned TM-1 by Israel, SpaceX, and then the other launch by SpaceX would be also the lunar lander by SpaceIL. And then there's another Soyuz spacecraft, Soyuz rocket that's going to be launched from French Guiana. It's going to carry 10 OneWeb, they call it pilot communication satellites. The first 10 of probably thousands that these companies are planning to launch. OneWeb is one of them. The idea is to have these things around 350 miles up so that they can have low latency for communications, and they'll be able to use it to have people that right now do not have easy access to the internet be able to get onto the internet with a small antenna from their home. So we'll see how that works out. The first 10 satellites to be launched coming up the day after the other launch. This will be on February 19th. Also, a Soyuz launch from Kazakhstan. We'll bring another crew of three up to the International Space Station to join the three that are up there. And then there's one cargo mission coming up also in March, middle of March, and that would be, again, SpaceX sending up a Dragon cargo vehicle to the space station. And that's pretty much all I got. Unless you, there's one other lunar mission I keep forgetting about, and that's by India. India has developed their own geosynchronous satellite launch vehicle. That's what they call it. It's a good-sized rocket, you know. It has that easy capability of putting satellites into geosynchronous orbit, which they've done many times so far. But they plan this time on launching a spacecraft to the moon. Chandrayaan is what they call it, number two. They've done number one. Number one put into orbit. Number two will be a lander. It's going to land roughly between they've given a location, but it's roughly around where Apollo 17 landed. But I think they'll just be happy to get it down to the ground. So it has a lander and it has a rover. So hopefully they can succeed in doing that as well. And that's the story on upcoming missions, and that's all within February and March. Who knows what April brings. This is WS2N for the SpaceNet Report on the TechNet. Any comments, questions? No, I guess not. I really don't have any other topics, so if you want to end early, or maybe Roy wants to cover something. I was interested in one of the topics that Roy had. I don't know if he wants to cover that now. And that would be, apparently they developed some kind of gadget where you receive brain waves from your head and convert that to a voice message. And if that's true, that would be an incredible step forward. But back to you, Dick, if any comments or questions on the SpaceNet report. That's it from here. This is WS2N.
Paul, where did you read that somebody can take the brain waves, no matter how you measure them, outside of a human head, and convert that into human speech? Boy, there's a big gap in there between those waves and human speech. Did somebody say that they had a technique for doing that? That sounds like that claim could be a hoax, so Paul, go ahead.
Let me go back. I have to reread that. I'm pretty sure that came across on Roy's email. I recently think I might have gotten that confused with something else. AC2GSWS2N, is that from you?
Yes, indeed, Paul. It came from me. It's a legitimate story if anyone wants to hear about it.
Give us a few words on that, because each human brain puts out a whole lot of signals at the surface, which is not necessarily near the speech center. And how in the world you take those waves from subject A, which is different than subject B, and convert that into a voice recognizable signal. Wow. Okay. Who did it? How successful? Does it work on more than one person? Go right ahead, Roy. Take your time on this one. Sounds like a tall story to me. Although I hope they've got it. KTRIW.
No, I think it's a legitimate story. I mean, it's sort of meant to demonstrate that people are working on this stuff, but they have a long, 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 long road to go. Basically, it's research published in Scientific Advances. It takes a important step closer to the goal, but instead of capturing an individual's internal thoughts to reconstruct speech, it uses brain patterns produced while listening to speech to devise such a speech prosthesis. Neuroscientists combined recent advances in deep learning with speech synthesis technology. The resulting brain-computer interface is still rudimentary and captures brain patterns directly from the auditory cortex, which is where they're decoded by an artificial intelligence-powered vocoder or a speech synthesizer to produce intelligible speech. So this device isn't translating an individual's covert speech, that is the thoughts in their head that are called imagined speech, directly into words. Unfortunately, they're not quite in direct terms of this. Instead, what this system accomplishes is the distinction of something called cognitive responses, that they listen to reported voices of people speaking, and they did the deep neural network analysis of people with seizure disorders that they could probe their brains. And they were actually able to decode and translate somewhat the patterns that allowed the system to reconstruct the speech. So basically, this is a bunch of epilepsy patients with electrodes in their head who sort of can train a artificial intelligence to figure out some of the words that someone says to them and then reduces it into vocalization. So it's a far step from...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Oops, sorry. I kind of overtalked, I guess. But basically, that's it. It's a relatively exciting, complicated little baby step in this technology where they're mapping the acoustic brain portions where we listen to voices, and they think they can decode simple words under these circumstances. But a lot more research is necessary.
I'm going to make a guess on this one, Roy, and you tell me if it's close to what you think they did. I'm measuring a whole lot of brain waves out of subject A, and the computer is being told to measure these brain waves because right now subject A is saying, hello, Paul. And then a little bit later, you tell the computer, measure these brain waves because the subject is saying, hello, Dick. And a little later, hello, Frank. And then hello, Roy. So of the four choices of brain waves you've just measured, now you randomly have subject A say, hello, Paul, hello, Roy, or whatever. And it compares the fifth brainwave pattern to the four it previously measured and said, hey, the closest I see is the pattern he measured when he said, hello, Paul. So the machine says, I think he said, hello, Paul. It isn't really reproducing the voice of the pattern. It is saying that that pattern is close to the previous memory sequence, and therefore I will say that this is hello, Paul. Is that possibly what took place, Roy? AC2GS, K2LIW.
Yes, Dick, that's pretty much what they did. They used some heavy-duty artificial intelligence software that teaches itself. So they offered it samples, described the words, offered more samples, and the artificial intelligence rewired itself optimally to guess correctly what the words were, and then they did this study. So it's a very, very initial, very primitive, not terribly exciting ultimately, but this, again, a baby step. You know, what we would like to hear, what people think is going on, is there some kind of magic chip that's going to just get input from your speech centers and send out a voice print to a voice box or something. And we can't even begin to guess how to do that. It's just, we know so little about how the brain truly works and how it encrypts and encodes and compresses information that we're just kind of guessing and plodding along. But you know, it's a nice thing that we're looking in that direction, although there are guys out there, I've heard them on repeaters, who are afraid that their glucometer chips, they put small glucometer chips under the skin so that they can sense what the blood sugar is in some cases. And they're only afraid that they're going to get mind control from their poor glucometer chips. So Brave New World isn't quite coming, but people are working on all kinds of fun things.
This process of giving it a priori knowledge that, hey, subject A is now saying this word, and memorize that pattern so that you can go back and predict that he's saying that particular word. By that process, make a guess, Roy, how big do you think the vocabulary of that computer was with subject A? Are we talking about four words? Or 400 words, how big do you think the vocabulary could have been? Over to you, Roy.
I'm hoping that they aimed for at least something like 100 words. The article, at least the article that wasn't behind the paywall, didn't really go into too many details of how many actual words were encoded and what the actual success rate was. But, you know, ultimately what you're somewhat more interested in is the basic underlying theory of how these things work rather than the degree of success, I guess. Because you could always build better versions of this technology. You can make electrodes that are much more dense to supply a lot more information of electrical activity in that portion of the brain. And you can tweak the algorithms of the artificial intelligence. So they think that they got a degree of success. If I can ever find a free copy of this particular article, I'll give it a look and report back. But, yeah, I thought it, you know, it sounds a little too sensational to be sort of true, and it is in a way, but it's legitimate to research.
Getting back to the previous subject of the number of Bibles that were on the microfilm that was taken to the moon, and that number was 512. Under normal circumstances, if you and I were experimenting as to how many microfilm Bibles I could squeeze into this particular page, I might go to 100, 200, 400, 800. In other words, if I was at 400, I would have four wide and 10 high or something like that, if you know what I mean, or five high and eight wide. But when you do binary arithmetic, you start off with 1, 2, you double it 4, double it 8, double it 16, 32, 64, 128, 256, 512. By simple doubling on each step, you come up with 512 and 1024 and 4048 and so on. So there's something magic about that number 512. It's 2 to the 9th power, done by a sequence of doubling. So how far they could take it and still squeeze it within the available space, I am guessing was done by a doubling process, and that's how that recognizable number, crazy-sounding number, but recognizable number for people who have ever been involved with binary arithmetic. Bunch of guesses on my part. Over to you, Roy, K2LAW.
I would sort of tend to disagree. Not that I know a great deal more than you do about any of this, but it came as rolls, apparently. So what they did was on the Apollo 14 mission, They pulled out 100 from the roll and gave it to the people at the lunar module. They rolled out the 200 from the roll and put it in the command module. And then some guy who just kind of tidies up and inspects the place before the rocket launches secreted out, in an additional 212 in another roll. So I don't think they were compacting it into space. I think they were more interested by the total weight. Each one was about a half a gram of the mass. So I don't think that that was the reason. I think that there's something kind of wonky numerological, either with 2 to the 9th, as you proposed, or as I read, which was 8 cubed, which 8 cubed is also 512.
Who told you 8 cubed is 512?
My calculator.
You're right. I did it wrong the first time. Oh, well. 8 cubed. 512. Okay. So they did something three times that started off with 8?
I don't know. I mean, again, I researched it because I really wanted to know if there was some number in the Bible that said 512 or some number that said 8 or some number. There's a lot of numbers that say 3, but I don't know. I would probably have to ask this pastor who passed away, or the guy who put the extra 212, secreted it into the command module to make another 512. It struck me as these guys really wanted to see 512 Bibles, and it was kind of funny that in the end it was actually 513.
Are you saying it was 513 or it was 512? I missed that one.
No, for Apollo 14, they took a roll of NCR King James Bibles, 100 of them, put it in the lunar module. They then took 200 off the roll and put it in the command module. Then the guy came in and snuck 212 to make it 512. But apparently they hadn't talked to each other, and someone decided that they wanted a really, really special first lunar Bible. So they had a print, a microfilm print, where on one side it was the King James Version, and on the other side it was the version that Ed White owned, who started it all by saying that he would have liked to have brought the first Bible to the moon before he was killed in the Apollo 1 accident. So it was 512 from the Prayer League, and then there was this first lunar Bible that was in addition to that. So it comes to 513. I don't know if they did that math.
Young, White, Chaffee, I think, were those the guys that died on Apollo 1? I don't know if Gus Grissom was involved in that one. Gus Grissom, on one of the Mercury missions, I think it was the second Mercury mission, had a large number of dimes stuffed inside of his spacesuit. And because the hatch got blown prematurely and the water started pouring into the spacecraft, and he had to go out and swim in that water, and lucky they were rescuing him real fast, the extra weight of all those dimes in his spacesuit almost drowned him. So with all the dimes he was bringing to the moon as souvenirs, it became a lethal procedure. And I am guessing NASA started clamping down on the kinds of souvenirs that could be brought. Over to you, Paul, K2LAW.
Oh, okay. Grissom, White, and Chaffee. Chaffee never flew. They were the three. I know a lot of water started to get into Gus Grissom's Mercury space suit. He lost the spacecraft. Especially I was recovered not too long ago. Back to you.
Question, Dick. Grissom didn't take any dimes to the moon. You mean into space?
He took them into orbit, and that made them souvenirs before we got to the moon. Just taking them into space made them into very valuable souvenirs, apparently. Roy, go ahead.
Yeah, suborbit.
I just wanted to make sure, because you mentioned the moon, and you didn't land there, but I mean, people will buy anything. Matter of fact, if you do a Google search on Lunar Bible, you'll see that people are paying $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 for some of these microfilms, and at least a few of them, my guess would be they were bought at that World's Fair, and they're complete counterfeit. But, you know, they scribble a little six-digit random number on the side, and they try and sell it for a lot of money.
Charlie Duke did stamps, though, right?
Well, I mean, there are certificates of authenticity. There's documentation of what the legitimate security six digits are. But I'm sure a couple of them got under the, you know, somehow. Someone finagled a private collector who has a beautifully displayed World's Fair NCR microfiche.
Yeah, I understood. Yeah, but I know Charlie Duke got in trouble with the stamps. So, you know, they thought they weren't making all that much money, some of these guys. And they thought they wanted to collect. Dick, over to you.
Charlie Duke was on which mission now, Paul?
Duke was, was it 15? I think, yeah. Irwin and, I'm trying to remember, Irwin. Have a way to remember this. No, he was with Young. Young just died recently. So you had Young, Duke, and Mattingly on Apollo 16. That's one of the ones that you heard.
I suddenly remember it. Mattingly, Young, and Duke, Apollo 16. And how long would it take you to come up with the names for Apollo 15?
Well, that's easier because I remember the first guy that died, the first astronaut that died, which was Irwin. He was on 15, and he went with Scott, and Warden was Warden stayed in the command module.
Yeah, Scott, Warden, and Irwin, gave a speech at a Deer Park High School, or was it North Babylon High School? I was present. I heard his speech.
That's pretty cool. And I know he was went looking for, he went out on some mountain looking for the Noah's Ark. I had another station there.
Yeah, that day, we'll pick him up in a second. The Noah's Ark search was Gus Grissom. Gus thought he had a religious experience while he was on the moon. Some deity talked to him while he was on the moon. And when he came back, down. He had a rough time going back to civilian life. I think he divorced his wife. He became alcoholic for a little while. And I think Grissom was the one who did the search for at Mount Ararat for Noah's Ark. Go ahead, Dave. Into APG, K2LAW.
That was definitely Irwin. And Grissom didn't make it to the moon.
Good evening, N2APG. Just a quick question. I was just wondering if anybody knows if any of the astronauts would have been able to get life insurance policies that would cover the risks, you know, involved with spaceflight. Go ahead, Dick.
I had Grissom on the mind, and then Buzz Aldrin. Didn't Buzz Aldrin, wasn't he the guy that divorced his wife, was alcoholic for a while, and did a search on Mount Ararat for the Noah's Ark? Wasn't that Buzz Aldrin, WS2N, K2IW?
No, everything was true, except for the for Noah's Ark. That was Irwin. When mountain climbing and all of that, looking for that Ark. But maybe Buzz Aldrin got involved too, maybe later on, that I don't know if it's possible.
Now, when it comes to Dave's question on insurance policies, what do we know about that one, Paul?
Well, they were, you know, covered by the, most of them were military, and, you know, NASA had all kinds of insurance on them, but not as much as you would think, because Grissom's wife sued NASA, and eventually won. Because of neglect with the Apollo 1 fire.
Did anybody else on the Apollo 1, any of those other families sue?
I know she did, but I don't think the other one did. So I'm not sure. You know, they might have settled before the suit ensued.
When it comes to the hatch that was on Apollo 1, in those days, because of what you and I would now consider an incomplete design, they had to remove the hatch from the inside by using a wrench to open up the bolts, which takes a whole lot of time. They weren't blown explosive bolts. So to open up that hatch when they had a fire inside, they needed to do it in 5 seconds, and the process by which they were going to do it was only going to take 5 minutes. Correct me on those numbers, Paul, go ahead, K2LAW.
It was Ed White's job. He was in the middle seat, and he was tall. He could reach it, but unfortunately, because of the extra pressure inside the Apollo 1, they said you could have had 100 Ed Whites in there, you wouldn't be able to open that up, and that was part of the redesign.
When he did loosen the bolt, did the hatch open up by going outward or inward, do you know?
It never opened up when he did it naturally. He eventually died, so it was the outside crew that eventually, that got him out in the white room.
Yeah, but if he could have loosened the bolts in time, which way did the hatch move? Did the hatch open by moving inward or by moving outward?
Yeah, it was inward, and then they changed it, because, with the extra pressure, it's impossible. That's one of the major redesigns. And that's why I'm not crazy about, I looked at Dragon, and they have it. It looks like it goes into me. I don't like that.
As far as the ceiling is concerned, inward is safer. But like you said, when there's pressure, they never got the pressure to go to zero on the lunar module, and therefore opening the hatch was very difficult. Do you remember that sequence?
The whole problem was they needed to go up to atmospheric pressure, right? That's what they wanted to do, because the ambient pressure was atmospheric, so they needed to go slightly above it. That they were duplicating 5 pounds of pressure, oxygen, pure oxygen, inside that spacecraft. So it was atmospheric, ambient pressure plus the 5 pounds, and that's what did it. In space, it would have only been 5 pounds on the inside, and not, and nothing on the outside.
And high pressure, pure oxygen is really a big burning. 73, you guys, we've used up our time. Bye-bye, you all, and see you next week. Roy and Paul, good stuff. And, we need more puzzles, Roy. I'm having some fun. Roy, for any final comments, AC2GS, K2RAW.
Yes, Dick, I just want to thank again everyone who participated, because especially the puzzles is a participatory thing. If people just kind of sit back and listen, it doesn't go anyplace. So thanks again to everyone, and I would love anyone to volunteer puzzles. They're very hard to mine. They're like gemstones these days.
73. We'll be back next week, Roy, Dick. This is better than the Super Bowl anyway. It lasts longer. We'll be back next week.
We don't really care, but who won the Super Bowl? The guy that was supposed to win?
Yes, New England.
And they've won a lot of times in the past, I presume.
Yeah, I think it was half a dozen. I guess this makes... Is this seven or is this six? I don't know. And they've been to the Super Bowl, I think, eight or nine times. Whatever. I'll be happy when a New York team makes it.
Roughly what time did the game end, Paul, if you happen to know?
That would have been 10 o'clock.
Oh, so we were only halfway through the internet when the game was over. And people are complaining that they're going to have trouble going to work tomorrow. I thought it was the game would play until midnight. 10 o'clock is not so bad. Bye-bye, you all.
The time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater. tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL Amateur Radio Repeater System. Tonight at 8:30, W2VL Repeater System. Tonight at 8:30, welcome to the W2VL Repeater. Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL Amateur Radio Repeater System. Tonight at 8:30, W2VL Repeater System. Morning. The time is 5 a.m. Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the W2VL Repeater. Thank you. at 8:30. This is the W2VL Amateur Radio Repeater System. Tonight at 8:30, W2VL Repeater System.
Traffic on the
tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the W2VL Repeater.
KD2KNH Mobile.
RBP listening.
Good morning, Matt. KD2KNH replying.
1147221 Lockfield. Nobody's realized, but the repeater was all, they put all kind of new equipment in. They repaired everything. I was talking to this guy, Bruno. He's actually one of the guys that repaired the repeater. So I threw my call and he came on. He spoke to me for a few minutes. Had to get back to doing the taxes. And then I jumped on over here now. So here I am.